WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Public Broadcasting Service is supposed to operate entirely free of political pressure. To that end, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was created as an independent body through which to funnel government support. Also to that end, only 5 members of CPB's 9-member board can be from one party. And also to that end, Congress funds CPB 2 years in advance to shield it from momentary bursts of partisan anger. President Johnson envisioned a moat between politicians and public broadcasting when he proposed the system. Ken Auletta, how did Wilbur Mills, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee at the time, respond to the president's metaphor?
Well, you know, Bill Moyers tells a great story. He was a young aide to Lyndon Johnson at the time, and Johnson told him that. And Wilbur Mills, they were sitting over bourbon, I assume it was bourbon. And he said, well, Lyndon, I want to help you. I want to do all I can for you. But Lyndon, if you were me, you wouldn't let them have that kind of independence.
Ken Auletta writes for The New Yorker. His new piece, Big Bird Flies Right, explains how Johnson's moat is rapidly being drained. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So PBS has always felt political pressure. Nixon tried to crush it. Reagan wanted to rescind CPB's appropriation. Politicians like Newt Gingrich openly went after it as a plaything of the elite.
As have Democrats, by the way, over the years.
But you suggest that these full frontal political attacks on public broadcasting didn't work because it turned out it wasn't the plaything of the elite, but most importantly, a healthy companion for kids. And why would anybody want to kill Big Bird?
Not only kids, which is 10 to 12 hours a day of children's programming on PBS, which makes it very popular, but also a source for news and public affairs for much of the rest of the country, particularly rural America, and particularly when you count public radio. And so what Gingrich discovered in the 96 election was after they Republicans attacked PBS and NPR and said we ought to get rid of it and stop funding it, they discovered that, in fact, their public, their constituents wanted it.
And so what you're suggesting in your piece is that there is now opposition from a new quarter, from within the CPB itself, the very institution that was designed to protect it.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting spends about $60 million or so a year on programming. When you see a program on the air, is partially funded by CPB in many cases, that is important seed money to go out and raise funds to pay for the rest of the cost of that programming. Now, obviously, the CPB does not control the airtime. The airtime is controlled by the stations and by PBS. The members of the Republican Party or the Bush administration appointees to the CPB, they feel that PBS tilts to the left and that a show like Moyers is a prime example of that.
We should identify Bill Moyers as not only a former aide to President Johnson, but also a longtime staple of public broadcasting and currently the host of Now with Bill Moyers, which has had a pretty strong anti-administration slant.
Yes. One of the things that offends them is that Bill Moyers not only serves as a kind of a host or anchor, but then often gives commentaries, and his commentaries are often very critical of the Bush administration and Republicans in general. So they are on the war path and have been to get Bill Moyers. And then the question is, by then pushing for a series of more conservative tilting shows, are they going too far?
Let's talk about those shows. CPB is backing the creation of programs with a right-wing tilt, like that of conservative Crossfire co-host Tucker Carlson and Wall Street Journal editorial page editor Paul Gigot. CPB will support those programs, but it says it has no intention of supporting Bill Moyers now. This agenda is pretty transparent, isn't it?
It seems so to me. And part of that transparency is when I asked the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Ken Tomlinson, I said, what is it you want to have? He said, I want a neutral host. And my model is, he said, C-SPAN. Well, the truth of the matter is that neither Tucker Carlson, who, you know, is no criticism of him personally, nor of Paul Gigot, again, no criticism of him personally, but neither of them are neutral hosts.
Let's talk about what the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 said about the role of public broadcasting. Is the number one element supposed to be balance? Is it supposed to be an alternative? Is it supposed to serve the underserved and give voices to minorities?
All of those are things that PBS, by the legislation that was passed in 1967, it's supposed to do. Now, how you prioritize that and what you value most is a question worthy of public debate. to date, we have not had that public debate.
Ken, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Ken Auletta's article, Big Bird Flies Right, appears in the latest issue of The New Yorker. And FYI, both On the Media and its producing station WNYC have been recipients of CPB grants.
The notion of taxpayer dollars subsidizing TV and radio with a perceived leftist tilt has long obsessed congressional Republicans. NPR and PBS, of course, deny having a liberal agenda. But what if an explicitly political program with extremist sentiments and ad hominem partisan rhetoric were distributed to government employees entirely at taxpayer expense? Well, say hi to the Rush Limbaugh Show, brought to millions of U.S. servicemen and women and their families for an hour each day on American Forces Radio. Salon.com senior writer Eric Bollert discovered this hidden in plain sight, and he joins me now. Eric, welcome back to OTM.
Good to be here.
All right, let's set the stage, please. What's American Forces Radio?
American Forces Radio is what everyone still refers to as Armed Forces Radio. It was created in the 40s by the government as a way to bring a, quote, taste of home to the troops serving overseas. It was also as a way to counterbalance the propaganda being broadcast by Tokyo Rose, etc. In the 50s, they added a television service. So today, when you're overseas, you can sort of get the greatest hits of American television and radio.
Okay, a little taste of home. Rush Limbaugh, the most popular radio show in America. That would seem to make some sense. What's the problem with it?
If you look at the lineup, it's sort of an innocuous collection of CNN headline news, some country music, some classic rock, some Christian programming on the weekend, some sports. And then for 1 hour every day, you get this rabid partisan political attack show on the radio. And there's a sense that, A, American Forces Radio is paid for by taxpayers, and probably not all taxpayers want to fund Rush Limbaugh. But second is that, okay, if you're going to have a right-wing talk show host broadcasting to the troops, find someone to create a counterbalance.
Is there no mandate for greater balance on its airwaves?
The guidelines do call for balance, particularly when it comes to political programming, and they have specific guidelines during presidential election years. I think the guidelines may sort of apply to Pentagon-produced news programs, but the guidelines clearly say that the programming on American Forces Radio and television should offer a diverse political opinion.
In your piece, you spoke to the director of American Forces Radio, and he says why we do have balance to Rush Limbaugh. We have
NPR.
Okay, and that counterbalances Rush Limbaugh and his assertion that the Abu Ghraib abuses and torture and possibly murders were nothing more than fraternity pranks. That counterbalances that how?
You know, that's the question. I mean, you have NPR, Morning Edition is broadcast, Talk of the Nation is broadcast. If you listen to those shows, you don't hear one person behind a microphone for 60 minutes talking about how women activists are equivalent to Nazis. So the idea that we can have Rush Limbaugh degrade Democrats for 60 minutes a day and then flip on Weekend Edition where you're going to interview poets and do some news updates, that's not a balance. That's not even close.
Now, this is all very interesting and easy to get inflamed about, but is there any reason to think that this has any ramifications in the real world?
Yeah, if you look at the 2000 election, specifically the Florida recount, it's not a stretch to say Bush is now president because of the overseas military ballots that came in. What's the implication of having Rush Limbaugh for 60 minutes a day telling troops, you know, that Democrats like terrorists, that Democrats are against the war, that John Kerry doesn't want to send the right kind of armor to protect them in the battlefield? Again, you're talking about a government-funded communications system that broadcasts worldwide this one singular partisan talk show host.
All right, Eric. As always, thanks a lot.
Okay. Talk to you, Bob.
Eric Bollert is a senior editor for Salon.com. Joining me now is Allison Barber, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. Allison, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Eric Bollert's piece raised the question, and I'll put it to you. Doesn't American Forces Radio have an explicit mandate to balance politically charged programming?
American Forces Radio has a mandate to do two things. The first is to provide a channel for commanders to have an access to be able to communicate with their deployed troops. The second mandate is to provide news, information, and entertainment for the morale of the troops that is similar to that of what they would have if they were not deployed.
Well, since you raised the issue of morale of the troops, are you comfortable with programming that dismisses, for example, the Abu Ghraib scandal as a frat prank, at the same time your own Department of Defense is launching courts-martial and investigations of torture and homicide?
The challenge for us is that part of our policy is also that we are prohibited to manipulate or censor. So not only is that something that is aired because we're not allowed to manipulate or censor programming, we also air news and information where people are sometimes critical of our troops. But the bottom line is the men and women in the military are smart people. They hear that as just somebody's opinion. They don't have to listen to it. They have options. They can turn off or turn on whoever they want to.
Well, not whoever they want to. They can turn on, for example, Howard Stern, the second most highly rated radio program in America and one that has taken a decided anti-Bush administration turn the last 6 months. If they can turn on Rush Limbaugh to hear him rant about feminazis, why can't they hear Howard Stern?
To be honest with you, our troops haven't asked for Howard Stern. We have some issues with some of the sexual content of Howard Stern, just like most Americans do.
Yet a moment ago you told me that you don't censor the information.
Once we make the decision to show whatever program we're showing, we're prohibited to censor or manipulate that programming.
But you can certainly stop distributing it. Do you know if there was any consideration when the Rush Limbaugh program took the Abu Ghraib situation and dismissed it as irrelevant, in fact, congratulated it as a brilliant maneuver? Was there any consideration to making the kinds of judgments that you made with the Howard Stern programming and just ceasing to offer it because it was offensive to the ideals of the American military?
I don't know of any serious consideration that was put to that specific issue. What I can say to you is that we're constantly reviewing what we carry on all of our networks, 12 radio stations, 6 television stations, and we're very responsive to our men and women in the military, who's our target audience. And so it's the challenge. When you open up the floodgates, when you open up these channels and say to them, we're going to give you choices, there's no way that you or I or anyone else would agree with everything you hear on the radio or everything you see on television. But what we've chosen to do is to put it out there and let the troops decide what they watch and what they listen to, just like we do here in America.
Okay, well, Allison, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Allison Barber is a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs.
Coming up, why the masses may be smarter than we think.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When technology and regulation converge, things can get expensive and weird. For instance, in 1997, Congress enacted legislation for the federal government to reclaim the analog broadcast spectrum, now allocated to TV, to be sold off to telecom companies for wireless phones and broadband. Broadcasters were in turn mandated to convert to all digital broadcasts, a conversion that will cost them at least $15 billion. Now the FCC has proposed speeding up that process. Even though most consumers get their TV through cable or satellite and never use their over-the-air TV tuners at all, and even though TV distribution through broadband may render the $15 billion digital broadcast infrastructure instantly obsolete. And whose lobbying led to this situation? Broadcasters. Joining me now to sort this all out is Tom Hazlett, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and former Federal Communications Commission chief economist. Tom, welcome back to our little slice of the spectrum.
Thank you.
Well, it sounds like a win-win-win-lose situation. Win because the government gets revenue from selling off these parts of the analog spectrum. Win because the economy will benefit and consumers will benefit from the services that are sold over this airspace. Win because those who do have HDTV will be able to get far more vivid television broadcasts. And lose because if you're in the broadcasting business, you have to spend between $15 and $20 billion to build out the digital broadcasting system.
And at the end of that day, the broadcasters will have spent a lot of money to broadcast into the ether, and not many people are out there waiting for those digital signals. you know, the fact is that 90% of households get their signals in a different way now, cable or satellite. And so this is a very heavy expenditure that's, in essence, being mandated by the government, both for new digital TV transmitters, the station expenditure, and the new rules that are going into effect starting this year, that new TV sets are going to have the capability to receive off-the-air digital signals. Consumers who pay more for TV sets because of that mandate might want to question the fact that they're paying for a vestigial organ, because they, in most cases, simply plug those TV sets into cable or satellite connections and never use that digital tuner.
If you believe, as I do, that over-the-air distribution of television programs is a dying business, that in the next 5 to 10 or, say, 15 years at the most, is simply not going to exist, isn't there a special level of unfairness to foot broadcasters for the bill for equipment that they're very quickly going to have no use for anyway?
I think that that's assuredly correct, but you've got to remember the essential irony, and that is that this whole rulemaking comes from broadcaster pleas that the very valuable radio spectrum allocated to analog TV broadcasting in the 1940s and 50s could not be shifted out to other uses in the 1980s. And in fact, the broadcasters claim that it had to be saved for high-definition programming to go out through the broadcast mode. Now they're being stuck with the bill for that policy.
So in the end, how will this affect you and me? Oh, well, I will throw that question. I know it's going to affect you. You're going to dine out on this for the next 10 years. But how's it going to affect me?
There's a tremendous opportunity out there for wireless technologies to provide not only voice service and the popularity of mobile phones, now used by 163 million U.S. subscribers, as testimony to how important that sector has become, but the great opportunity in high-speed internet connections via wireless, with the reallocation of airwaves to invigorate that market opportunity. I think that not only can you access the internet on a mobile basis at a very low cost and with very high performance, but that you might just be getting over-the-air television in a new form, the IP form, the internet-connected video product may well reemerge, but it'll look a lot different than the old analog broadcasting system that's, in fact, still with us today.
Well, Tom, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Hazlett is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research.
This year, Vladimir Putin won the Russian presidency in a landslide, with the help of a press bound by new rules barring commentary and restricting coverage of his challengers. But in his victory speech, Putin proclaimed that he would do everything, quote, to ensure the freedom of the mass media. Well, not this week. The widely admired TV anchorman Leonid Parfionov was fired from the nominally independent NTV network for two misdeeds. First, he enraged the Kremlin by airing an interview with the widow of a Chechen leader who'd been allegedly murdered by Russian security services. It was broadcast in eastern Russia but was pulled before it could air in the West. Then the newsman told the newspaper Izvestia all about the censorship. "I've worked as a journalist for 25 years," he said, "and for all those 25 years I've heard, it's not the right time yet, brother, it's not the right time. It's about time to understand that information has an intrinsic value. It is neither harmful, nor useful, nor useless." Fred Weir covers Russia for the Christian Science Monitor, and he joins me on the line from his home near Moscow. Fred, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's examine the role of the news anchor, Leonid Parfionov. Now, 3 years ago, NTV, which had been one of Russia's most aggressively independent news outlets, was taken over by the state-owned gas company Gazprom. And 2 years ago, many of its leading journalists left because of a conflict with the Kremlin, but Parfionov did stay. Why did he stay?
He stayed because he said himself he really doesn't like conflict like this. And because he believed the promises that NTV's independence would be preserved. He didn't show solidarity with the other journalists at that time, and all of them have had a bad fate since. They've been run out of two more TV networks since that time. But Parfionov, to a certain degree, he's been able to do what he does. He clearly just ran up against the brick wall.
Would you say that this firing was inevitable?
I think so, and I think that the trend lines are absolutely clear. People who go beyond certain limits, and I think those limits are constantly being adjusted, will be punished. Already in the last 4 years, most of the Russian media has been poured into a straitjacket, and we have seen consistently the noose being tightened. This is not the first instance of this happening, and it more or less makes a mockery of everything that Putin said, both in his election acceptance speech, which you quoted, and in his State of the Nation address last week.
How's the firing playing there in Russia? Is there any reaction from the media, or at least from the journalistic community?
Yes, of course. There is a union of journalists in Russia, which is still independent and pretty combative, and it has taken a strong stand in favor of Parfionov. Most of the people I talk to are really outraged. But, you know, in Russia today, there aren't a lot of outlets for protest. You know, if you ask Russians on principle, do you value democracy, they'll think of the chaotic and dismal experience of the last 10 years and say, don't need it. But if you ask them something specific, like, are you sorry Parfionov has been taken off the air, they will say, yes, definitely.
The political analyst Lilia Shetsova told the Financial Times that Parfionov's work didn't fit into the Soviet brand of television. She said it was an element of spring at a time when the rest of the country had entered autumn.
Yes, indeed. And there are a couple others like that that you want to watch now. There's Savik Schuster, who also works for NTV. There's Vladimir Posner, who a lot of Americans may know because he speaks perfect English, who has his Vremena program on the state-owned ORT program. Those people are also pushing the limits and could very well be next in line to be fired.
Do you think Russia then, despite all of Putin's promises, inexorably is entering autumn?
That's too hard a question. I don't believe the sort of high-sounding promises that Putin is making. I think there's a vast bureaucratic momentum behind his reestablishment of state power. He's doing it for economic reasons. He wants to modernize the country, but he believes very strongly that dissent must be crushed in order for economic efficiency to triumph.
Why does he keep making these promises about freedom of expression all the time, then? Is it for the domestic audience or for the foreign one?
I think he may sort of believe it. You have to remember, I mean, I'm old enough to have listened to lots of speeches by Soviet leaders, and they all talked a good show about freedom and progress and all of that, too.
But you wouldn't say Stalin believed his own promises. Do you think that Putin does?
Maybe. And I'm even willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. But the reality here, when it comes to setting priorities, is that freedom of expression is definitely not a priority in Putin's Russia.
Well, Fred, thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Fred Weir is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from his home just outside Moscow.
And here are two more updates from these shores. In March, we told you about a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and several marijuana reform groups against the government and the Washington, D.C. metro system. The ACLU claimed that part of the federal 2004 spending bill violated the First Amendment because it cut off funding from public transit authorities that accepted advertising criticizing the government's war on drugs. Complying with the new law, the D.C. metro system refused to run a series of ads that claimed there were serious negative consequences to the government's fight against marijuana use. Well, on Wednesday, a U.S. District Court judge confirmed the ACLU position, striking down the so-called Iztok Amendment, named after the Republican congressman who championed it. Judge Paul L. Friedman's decision calls the government's attempt to censor the transit ads, quote, illegitimate and constitutionally impermissible. He also issued a permanent injunction prohibiting the law's enforcement.
And a recent tragedy recalled an interview we did in August of 2002 when Sheriff Fred Abdallah of Jefferson County, Ohio, detained a mother at a carnival because her three children seemed to be suffering from severe sunburn and other medical problems. The sunburn sheriff, as he was dubbed, became something of a media punchline. News organizations all over the world covered the story, or at least a partial version of it, portraying the sheriff's action as a gross overreaction to the normal wear and tear of childhood. But when we spoke to Sheriff Abdallah, he explained that he felt more than justified in taking action against this mother, despite the heckling from the media.
But you know what, Brooke? I could sleep good at night, and I can get up in the morning and look in the mirror real well, and don't have a problem. I wouldn't have been able to go to bed at night if I hadn't done anything, and one of those children would have been killed, or died, rather. I just couldn't live with myself.
But last month, one of the children in the sunburn case, a 2-year-old named Timothy, died. His parents are being charged with reckless homicide and child endangerment. The tragedy of this toddler's death suggests that Sheriff Abdallah wasn't overreacting when he decided to pursue charges against the mother, no matter what the media said about it.
Googlers, beware. The web's most popular search engine is rapidly becoming the newest front in the battle for the White House. Type the word waffles into the search box, and number one on the list of results won't be a recipe for grandma's finest, but rather the campaign site for John Kerry. The Democratic hopeful has been Google-bombed. Earlier this year, searches for the term miserable failure started returning bios of George W. Bush. Harmless prank? Maybe. Google bombs are certainly not going to affect the outcome of the election. But New Yorker columnist James Surowiecki wrote last week that Google bombing, quote, exemplifies one of the biggest challenges that Google faces as it heads towards its multi-billion-dollar IPO. James Surowiecki joins me now. James, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
What is it about Google that lets these dirty tricks get played?
Well, the way Google decides which pages come up first when you do a search, it uses a variety of mechanisms. But at the core of it, what it does is it asks web pages and web page producers essentially to vote on which pages will be most relevant. And it does that essentially by treating a link from one page to another as a vote. Obviously, miserable failure does not appear on the page that has George Bush's biography at the White House website. But if you link to the biography using the phrase miserable failure, Google essentially tracks that. And so what people realized was they could essentially fool Google into thinking that that was the page that had the best information for miserable failure.
Now, subverting the system isn't just a game for tricksters. Businesses have a great stake in what comes up first under web searches. How do they go about seeding the clouds to get clicked on first?
Well, there's an entire industry which goes by the name generally of search engine optimization. And they use a variety of tactics. Some of them are what are called white hat tactics. Google also looks, for example, at where words are on a page, how close words are to each other on a page, font size. And a lot of what optimizers do is try to optimize these. So if you are offering real estate in Charlotte, North Carolina, your page will show up high on the rankings. And that seems totally reasonable. But there are also black hat tactics. Coders are able to write pages that fool Google into thinking it's saying one thing, but then when you click on it, it shows you something entirely different.
It sounds, at least at first blush, like a bug in the Google algorithm, but really it's just opportunists exploiting the very essence of what makes Google such a good search engine to begin with, right? Because
yeah,
it credits the wisdom of the masses.
Exactly.
This, conveniently enough, gets to your larger theory on the wisdom of crowds as fleshed out in your new book. Tell me about the premise of your book.
Well, the simple premise is that under the right circumstances, groups are often smarter than even the smartest person within them. And I argue that this phenomenon can be seen over and over again. You can see it at the racetrack, where racing odds basically predict how likely it is that horses will win. You can see it in the stock market. And you can see it in quite mundane examples, like if you ask a group how many jelly beans are in a jar, the average guess will invariably be within about 2% of the total, and it will be better than 96 or 97% of the people in the group.
When the people on Wall Street discuss this phenomenon, they say that the tape knows. The aggregate of all the information by all the people buying and selling is greater than that of the greatest experts on the market. And I guess that's true, but there's a difference between a crowd and a mob.
Yes.
The bubbles and the crashes in the stock market are the work of a mob, out of control. Lynchings are the work of a mob. And I guess Google bombing is the work of a mob.
Well, the Google bombers are like a mob in this sense. What distinguishes a crowd or a group from a mob is that mobs are sort of single-minded, and that instead of people thinking for themselves, they're all moving in the same direction. And in a sense, that's exactly what Google bombers are doing. They're all acting in collective in order to achieve what the group wants. They're not doing it as a result of independent judgments. And that's the real paradox, I think, and the real challenge Google faces. Google, in a sense, works best when no one's really paying attention to it. And I sort of have this image that what Google really would like, and I think in a strange way what would be best for all of us, is if, you know, they could just kind of hide in the corner and look at us making our decisions about what web pages are most valuable. That's really how Google built the better mousetrap that made it the success that it is.
Well, James, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
James Surowiecki writes the Financial Page column for The New Yorker magazine. He's author of the new book, The Wisdom of Crowds, Why the Many Are Smarter Than the Few, and How Collective Wisdom Shapes Business, Economies, Societies, and Nations.
Coming up, how some political operatives are made and how some, like Karl Rove, are born, and why campaign reporters won't call a spade a spade.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In these polarized times, the politically savvy find allies wherever they can. College campuses are regarded as hotbeds of liberalism, but conservatives also find them fertile ground, and groups like the College Republicans have been fostering movers and shakers for decades. Since 1979, the Leadership Institute, an Arlington, Virginia think tank, has seen 30,000 students walk through its doors and emerge conservative political operatives. Hosting dozens of seminars, classes, and internships, the Leadership Institute is the Walmart of conservative thought, offering lessons in everything from candidate development to television techniques to starting college newspapers. On the Media's Sarah Lemanchek went to the front lines.
A lot of times conservatives complain about the media, and we always stress at the Leadership Institute, conservatives should not complain about the media. Conservatives should be the media.
For the past decade, the Leadership Institute has been putting on a traveling roadshow of conservative journalism, encouraging conservative students to take a more active role in campus politics. Josh Mercer is the current director of student publications.
We don't endorse any specific candidate for office. We don't wear any politicians' pins on our suits. We just want people to think a little bit more critically about issues from a traditional family values and free market approach.
What they do is start college newspapers. And if Josh Mercer were the Lone Ranger, then Owen Brennan Rounds would be Tonto. A one-time speechwriter for former New York City Mayor Giuliani, Owen gallops alongside Josh from college to college.
Newspapers have sort of a soul. They have a mission statement. They have a purpose. They have a point of view. They're very different from a daily paper that just seeks to sort of be, quote, objective.
For Owen, objectivity is a delusion of the complacent, narcissistic, liberal press.
They don't teach this in journalism schools. They don't teach people to go out and be a pit bull reporter anymore. They teach journalists, you know, it's more of a trade school now where the, you know, the pinnacle achievement is going out and writing a story about why Aunt B has the finest pie stand in all of Washington County. You know, we want to be more of a cavalry.
Riding into battle are students like Chris Pryor, editor-in-chief of The Fountainhead, an ally-supported paper out of the University of Oklahoma. He remembers his introduction as a freshman to the staff of The Fountainhead.
they had us go around the room and introduce each other and ask what books we would like to see burned. And yeah, that seems real, and it is real. But that's just kind of the introduction I got to these guys. They're way out there, and they're certainly blood and guts conservatives, which is something you don't see very often on campus.
They impressed Chris enough to make him want to write for the paper, and later to spend the summer as an intern at the Leadership Institute, a place where he picked up some jargon and a belief in the Allies' outsider tactics.
We are five or six guys, and sometimes girls, putting together a newspaper in my place. It's a different kind of environment. The LI even has a name for them. I think they call them 3AMers, people who stay up way late and do these kind of covert type things. That's the real attitude that you get with these people. These are people who want to go out there and they have something in mind that they want to defeat.
The ranks of the Leadership Institute talk a lot about the war of ideas. Chris and other LI alum are waging a war against what they consider to be the hegemony of left-leaning institutions. Josh Mercer remembers the moment he knew he had to fight. It was at a campus lecture, listening to a conservative speaker discuss the controversial murder case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Most of the people that are standing up and screaming and yelling were not actually college students themselves. They were local community activists, people who work, I presume, full-time to try to convince students to become socialists. And I thought, well, you know, it's about time that we had more people dedicated to the cause of freedom and introducing young college conservatives to a different perspective.
Perspectives he believes are not being addressed in the established campus papers. The Fountainhead Editor-in-Chief, Chris Pryor.
When we take on a professor for being extremely feminist, I mean, to the point of ludicrousness, students in that classroom won't have the fear of thinking, you know, if I speak up against this professor, I'll get an F in this class because look at the Fountainhead. They're doing it too. Geez, they put her picture next to a mummy. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, we can do now.
Journalists are always going to have a perspective that they're writing from.
Again, former Giuliani speechwriter Owen Brennan Rounds.
If they work for a news organization where that perspective is understood, that makes them more effective at communicating their message.
Allison Kasich is the editor of The Counterweight from Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. In the 3 years since its founding, The Counterweight has gone from a small newsletter to a 20-page paper with a full-color cover.
We've really been fighting the speech code at Bucknell. That was an issue that really went unnoticed until we decided to write about it in The Counterweight.
The paper considers campus rules against racially or sexually derisive language to be a violation of free speech.
That's kind of the strategy when you're fighting these things, is that the administration can't justify in the public eye what they kind of do in private. What we've been doing is ever since that we kind of brought this issue into the limelight, we've printed the speech code in every single issue of The Counterweight, and we'll continue to do that until the speech code doesn't exist anymore.
To ensure the continued existence of The Counterweight and other conservative papers, the Leadership Institute employs field reps on call for any kind of neocon, libertarian, free market crisis the student papers might have. And the papers are thriving. The California Patriot was started nearly 4 years ago with the Allies' help. And even before Arnold Schwarzenegger, it ignited enough conservative sparks to start three new papers in California. And according to Owen, that's only the beginning.
The students who are putting these publications together today have much more in common with sort of the pamphleteers of the revolution. It's not quite Tea Party-esque, but you know, these are the first bubblings of revolution on campus.
The Leadership Institute has helped start over 80 papers so far, leaving, according to their calculations, about 3,000 campus news racks ripe for occupation. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Lemanchek.
Since we ran that piece in December, Josh Mercer, the director of student publications for the Leadership Institute, has moved on, we're told, to become the political director for the Ave Maria List, a pro-life Catholic PAC. Allison Kasich, the editor of The Counterweight, a conservative paper at Bucknell University, remains a member of the Bucknell Conservatives Club and will graduate in 2005. The others are either in their same posts or we couldn't track them down. That's kids for you.
Back in 1973, Karl Rove was president of the College Republicans, and as far back as his college days, he had a reputation as a pioneer in hardball campaigning and media manipulation. Now, of course, political mavens regard him as the second most powerful man in the White House, except for those who see him as the most powerful man in the White House. Certainly, that's the assessment of Joe Mealy and Michael Paradis Shoup, who produced and directed Bush's Brain, a documentary based on the book of the same name that dissects the brilliant, if bloodstained, career of the president's chief advisor. Joe and Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So your story is a textbook account of how the road to political success is paved with dirty tricks. We begin to see some of the classic rogue media tactics begin to emerge, I guess, in a 1986 race in Texas for governor between Republican Bill Clements and Democrat Mark White. Clements was a rogue client, and just as the race became very even, a bugging device was found in Rove's office. Here's a clip from Glenn Smith, the former editor of the Houston Post.
The first words out of my mouth were, call Rove, put that bug there, see if you can get that. Because it was so Rove-like.
We talked to a number of journalists at that time, and virtually all of them felt it was what they called the mark of Rove. They felt Rove had bugged his own office. But what's interesting to note is that they, without exception, felt they had to investigate it, they had to report it, and as a result of investigating it and reporting it, enough doubt was shed on the Mark White campaign that it changed the election.
The timing was that there was a debate the following night, and Bill Clements was not considered a very good debater, but all the attention of the press went on to the bugging incident and not on to the debate and the results of the debate.
Clements won the election.
Another media management technique employed by Rove that you document could be called strategic leakage. The issue of leaks dates back to 1980, the Reagan campaign. You say that Rove was fired for leaking.
Yes, that was a leak to Robert Novak, actually, involving Rob Mosbacher. Rob Mosbacher was an operative in the Bush 1 campaign with Rove. And Rove leaked to Robert Novak that Mosbacher had done a terrible job. It came out in Novak's column, and Rove was fired.
Let's talk about leaks to Novak. Here in 2004, we have one hell of a leak that has the president hiring a lawyer this week. It was the name of a CIA operative given to columnist Robert Novak, among other more discreet reporters. The operative's husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, quotes Rove saying that Wilson's wife was fair game.
I think there's no question that this is more of the same of Karl Rove. I mean, he has a history of doing this in Texas, and now as a political advisor to the president, we see more of it. I mean, we're not saying that he necessarily was the one who did the leak, but he was the one who told people that Valerie Plame is fair game.
Let's move on to what you call the whisper campaign. You suggest that this is his signature technique. It was very clear beginning in 1994, the race for governor between George W. Bush and the incumbent Ann Richards.
In the Ann Richards campaign, the whispers were, as one journalist said to us, it was thick-neck white guy says that could she be a lesbian?
It starts by having leaflets on cars at churches in the South, and then conservative talk radio. There'll be different people calling and mentioning this, and it just sort of builds from that.
Do political analysts attribute the Richards loss to the whisper campaign?
Her press secretary said to us, if Karl Rove is the mastermind and takes credit for all the good things that happened for a Bush campaign, at the end of the day, he has to take credit for the stinky things that happened. What I found in talking to journalists and found very frustrating is they know basically what's going, but they cannot absolutely prove Karl Rove's fingerprints aren't on the gun.
Let's move on to an even stinkier whisper campaign. That was the one against John McCain in the South Carolina primary during his run for president. Here's a clip from the film of Molly Ivins.
This is the very gentle whispering campaign. It started in Washington. And people would say, you know, poor John, he had a very tough war. And he was a prisoner for a long time. And he really, you know, his temper is very bad. And he's blah, 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 blah. And there was this little buzz.
There were a number of rumors also that John McCain had a black love child. In fact, they had adopted a baby from Mother Teresa in Bangladesh.
A call is placed to talk radio. And someone says, am I to understand that John McCain has a black love child? And soon as that's out there and asked a number of times, the truth becomes really less significant than the rumor.
Who placed these calls to talk radio, do you think?
What do you think?
Yeah, a number of different people, but they all get the same question and the same statement.
And as John Weaver, who directed the McCain campaign and worked with Rove for Bill Clements, said that the responsibility for these kinds of things begins and ends with the top of the campaign, and the top of the campaign is where you have to look for the responsibility.
It wasn't just a whisper campaign. It was a slew of negative ads. And you used the taking down of Georgia Democrat Senator Max Cleland to illustrate that part of the Rove technique. Can you describe those ads?
Yeah, sure. There would be a photo of Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and then Max Cleland. And then afterward, the ad would say that
Max Cleland says he has the courage to lead, but the record proves Max Cleland is just misleading.
It was outright character assassination of a man who'd lost three limbs in the Vietnam War. So why did the public buy those ads?
I think because the public simply doesn't look deeply enough into these issues. If you research this at all, the idea of comparing Max Cleland's service record with George W. Bush's service record is absurd. But at a time where there was great patriotic fervor in the wake of 9/11, I think these were very effective. And with Karl Rove, it's all about effective strategy. It's not about the truth.
Now, Bush's brain is outright political advocacy. You have a lot of people saying that there's no way to tell where Rove ends and Bush begins, but I don't think you really make that case. And even the chilling electioneering that you offer lacks, you know, smoking gun conclusive evidence, as you said, though you make a pretty compelling circumstantial case. Do you think that you're going to be subject to charges that this is just a hatchet job?
You know, it, as one review said, depending on your politics, you think this is a brilliant documentary, and if you oppose it politically, you think it's propaganda.
What we hope to do is create a dialogue about the election and show people when they see something happening that's coming out of the White House, give them a way to interpret it.
Joseph Mealy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Michael Paradis-Shub, thank you too.
Thank you.
They produced Bush's Brain, based on the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential by Wayne Slater and James Moore. It should appear at your local theater sometime this summer. Truth squatting, the journalistic practice of vetting political ads for factual accuracy and context, has become quite common, and not for nothing. Political parties and consultants, under the innocent-sounding rubric of opposition research, tirelessly mine opponents' voting records and public statements, among other sources, for opportunities to smear. The trick? To turn benign facts into toxic sludge. Here, an obscure writer to a 400-page bill on something else. There, a partial quote lifted out of context to reverse its original meaning. The little truth squad boxes on page A28 or whatever are newspapers' modest attempts to set the record straight. For all the good they've done, as this fledgling presidential race amply demonstrates, things have only gotten worse and worse. So last week, in an unusual display of display, the Washington Post took the Truth Squad from inside the paper to the front page with an exhaustive look at the Bush-Kerry race so far.
It was a horrifying view, with one example after another of malignant distortion on both sides, although overwhelmingly by the Bush-Cheney campaign. The Post's headline, From Bush, Unprecedented Negativity. Negativity? Well, yeah, the ads attack Kerry on the economy, on taxes, on the war on terrorism, and so on. But negativity is hardly the point.
While wiretaps, subpoena powers, and surveillances are routinely used against drug dealers and organized crime, Kerry would now repeal the Patriot Act's use of these tools against terrorists.
Quite an explosive charge. If it were true, which it isn't. Kerry has simply called for these tools to be subject, as in all criminal investigations, to judicial review. The Washington Post story harvested many such examples, including the president's claim that Kerry would raise the federal gasoline tax 50 cents per gallon. In fact, as the president well knows, though Kerry discussed such an increase in one newspaper quote 10 years ago, he is against anything like it now. What do you call that kind of gross misrepresentation? Well, let's look in the dictionary, shall we? What is anything meant to deceive or give a wrong impression? Why, it's called a lie. You can soften it by calling it misleading or stretching the truth, as the Post did, but it's still a lie.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
Which makes George W. Bush, the President of the United States, a liar. Oh, so is Kerry, of course, albeit less nakedly and less often. So why are we talking about negativity when the problem is honesty? When consumer advertisers behave this way, as KFC and Anheuser-Busch discovered only this week, they are hauled before the Federal Trade Commission and the federal courts. When the candidates to lead the free world do it, the headlines shrug. Where is the outrage? Credit the Washington Post for unburying the truth. Now it's time, at long last, to call a thing by its name. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Volo and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.